Welcome again to another edition of Secrets of Meaning, the podcast and TV show of Armos Jewish Sacred Aging. I'm your host, Rabbi Richard Address. We welcome you to these podcasts. We explore some of the aspects of our own aging, the implications of the aging revolution on our families, our communities, etc. We invite you to follow us on our website, jewishsacredaging.com, and if you'd like to, visit us at the Jewish Sacred Aging Facebook page. We are delighted to welcome colleague, prolific author, congregational rabbi, former president of the World Union for Progressive Judaism, lots of things to go on the back of his baseball card. And so it's a pleasure to welcome Rabbi Stephen Fuchs, currently the rabbi of Bat Yam Temple of the Islands in beautiful Sanibel, Florida, which is really beautiful place to daven, you know, not quite southern New Jersey, but, you know, it'll have to do. Steve, how are you? Welcome.
I'm well. Thank you so much, Rabbi.
Oh, Rabbi. Okay. We've known each other. So I want to talk with you about some of the issues that you raise in several of your more recent books. And as I said in the introduction, you are a prolific author have a sense of many aspects of not only the American Jewish community, because of your personal background and your World Union presidency, the global, in many ways, progressive Jewish community, which we'll get. But I want to start with one of these books called What's in It for Me? Finding Ourselves in Biblical Narratives, which is always fascinating to me as a rabbi and as somebody who teaches in the DMIN program at HUC, in the use of biblical narratives and biblical personalities instances in a pastoral counseling situation. But you write in the preface, quoting your former rabbi, Rabbi Soltis Oliver Shalom, was saying that one of the marks of a mature person is the development of a personal philosophy of life. What's your personal philosophy of life?
My life counts. Many times I find myself wishing, oh, I wish I could have done more grandiose things. But it's the little things that count. And the opportunities that I've had in my career to make a difference in somebody's life, being with them when they're grieving, sharing their joy, perhaps teaching a class that resonates and have somebody tell me 20 years later something I said that I've forgotten that they've remembered. Those are the things that are really, really important to me. And the awareness that my life does count is at the core of my philosophy of life, because I think that when we accept the fact that each of us has the potential of enhancing the divine image in which we're created, then I think life becomes more meaningful and purposeful and joyful.
The use of biblical narratives, Steve, in this book, What's in It for Me, Finding Ourselves in Biblical Narratives. How did you, first of all, come to write this, but also, what's the power of the biblical narrative, the metaphors of family systems, individual encounters? They really are not biblical. They're really, you know, they're right out of everyday life, right?
Yes, no question about it. I guess to start with how I came to write it, long ago, when I was a young rabbi in Columbia, Maryland, the Baltimore Board of Rabbis invited me to teach the 10-session Introduction to Judaism class for the conservative and reform rabbis of the greater Baltimore area. This was before there was any UAHC or URJ curricula or anything of that nature. Go to it. You got 10 sessions. Do what you want. Looking for resources back in the 70s, I found that there were lots of books on Jewish history. There were books on modern Jewish thought. There was almost nothing about Torah from a non-Orthodox perspective. And so I began to look at the question of where is truth in Torah? And it was clear to me that it was not in history. There's a lot that's not historical. It's certainly not scientific. I don't look at the creation story in Genesis, for example, as a science text. The truth of biblical stories, it became clear to me, is in what they teach me. And I find that when I study the characters, I learn things that can help me be a better person. And I began to write this stuff. And this book really gestated for 40 years. And when I did my DMin at Vanderbilt in biblical thought, which was a great opportunity for me, I wrote this in a more academic way. And then finally, I decided years later that I wanted to bring it out as a popular book. And now it's in revision, by the way, and it will be coming out again soon under a new title, Finding Ourselves in the Bible. My critic said that the title was too cumbersome, so there it is.
Do you use the biblical narratives and the biblical personalities in your own pastoral counseling work?
At times, yes. It depends whom I'm dealing with, and depends, of course, on the situation. But I find them very, very helpful. For example, this coming Shabbat, I will speak about Cain and Abel. I think that John Steinbeck was absolutely right when he called it the symbol story of the human soul. And his great work, East of Eden, is really an 800-page midrash on Cain and Abel. Right. And Steinbeck's point is the story of all of us, because like Cain, we've all faced rejection. And I believe dealing with rejection is something we all have to learn. And the better we get at it, the happier we're going to be.
In the biblical narrative book, you spend some time writing about this little Hebrew word. And for those Hebrew scholars out there, you know, sometimes there are little Hebrew words that really are high holiday sermons. And that little word is ki'ilu, which you use as if. Why is that such an important word?
Well, how do I get beyond the notion that I don't really believe when I stand in front of a congregation on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur that God is up there judging me? But if I can act as if that were the case, and as if literally during these days of awe, I am on trial for my life, and I can then act as if, yeah, my balance scale is equal, as the Talmud says, and my next deed is going to determine my fate, well, then the chances are pretty good that I'm going to try to make that next deed a good one. And if everyone resolved to do that, in other words, if everyone able to act ki'ilu, as if this were the case, as if God were judging us, and if we needed to up our game in terms of the acts of kindness and caring and compassion that we perform, especially as we get older, I think we're going to have a better world. So ki'ilu is a very important concept to me.
One of the other books that I wanted to talk to you about is this very, very fascinating book called And Often the First Jew, subtitled Kristallnacht Survivor Son Teaches Holocaust History in Germany. First of all, tell us about your father.
My dad grew up in Leipzig, Germany, where he lived very happily for the first 25 years of his life. But he was one of 500 German men in Leipzig who was arrested on Kristallnacht. The rest of his family had already left, and my dad never spoke about this. In fact, I didn't know what Kristallnacht was, and I say this with no pride, until I was 22 years old, beginning my studies at the Hebrew Union College in Los Angeles. And I'm sure you heard Rabbi Gottschalk of blessed memory tell about his grandfather, in Oberswalde and how he was wading into the Rhine River, clutching charred scraps of Torah scrolls to his breast on Kristallnacht. And I thought to myself, how terrible. What a horrible thing to have happened. And later that spring, I learned that my own father had been arrested. He never spoke about it, ever. So when the opportunity came for Vicky and me, my wife Vicky and me, to go to Germany to do three things, basically, to teach together in German high schools about the Shoah, because Vicky's parents are also from Germany. And then I've spoken in some 24 German churches, and of course taught in synagogues and conducted services and taught seminars at the Geiger College in Berlin. So the title of this book comes from the fact that when I walked into a church, a beautiful little church in a remote German village in Schleswig-Holstein with 1220 on the cornerstone. And the person who greeted me said, Rabbi, we are very proud and happy to welcome you, but I want you to know that you are the first Jew most of our listeners have ever seen. And I found that to be true in many, many of the churches where I've had the privilege to speak in Germany. And so that's how the title came along. And of course, it began with my first visit to Leipzig in 1982, where I really had to sneak into the country. I was turned away at a border crossing and sent to Berlin, where I reinvented myself as an art teacher, not as a rabbi. I wanted to see where my father grew up. And I was praying that they didn't ask me very much about art because my knowledge is limited. But I got my visa to go to Leipzig literally through the back door. And I compare and contrast that to 2014 when we were welcomed to Leipzig and I was to speak at not one but three different Kristallnacht commemorations on November 9th, which is, of course, the night of Kristallnacht. And so I just was so moved by the change, you know, with the downfall of East Germany, if you will, and all of that that went with it, and the warmth with which we have been greeted in Germany, it was very, very special. And that's how that book came about.
There is a passage in And Often the First Jew that I have to ask you about, because if you ever do this as a film, this has to be the opening scene. And it has to be in black and white.
Okay.
But you write about you're coming in to Leipzig and seeing it for the first time, and it hits you that this was probably the last view that your father had when he was being taken away. Those two sentences. Talk to me about that. What was that feeling like? I mean, what was it like?
It was heart-wrenching. It was heart-wrenching. Especially the Leipzig train station is one of the biggest in Europe, by the way. And it's quite modern. And the contrast between this city now and the way it was and the type of train that I imagine my dad being transported to Dachau in was, it made me shudder. And it was a very, very powerful and motivating image. I really was speechless about it for quite a while, but it really is something that stays with me to this day.
You have a career that's marked by a lot of very, very powerful interfaith work.
Oh, yeah.
Not only here, but all over the world. When in the early days of my rabbinate, interfaith work was in many cases really a high priority. My sense is, and I needed to ask you about this because of the Often the First Jew book and also knowing of some of your work. There seems to be a diminution in the importance of this in contemporary American Jewish life. Am I wrong at this, or are you picking up the same thing? And if so, why?
I think I'm not sure why. I do perceive that there is a diminution of its importance. But for me, it has always been vital. I feel like I'm very proud to be Jewish, and I want to share that pride and the universal values that emanate from Jewish thought with non-Jews at every opportunity that I have. To me, I've always said, Jews are not responsible for anti-Semitism. Anti-Semites are. But on the other side of that equation, the more we are open and eager to educate and share the beauty of our tradition and our thought processes, the better off we're all going to be. I consider myself fortunate that the congregation I served for 13 years at the beginning of my career, and as the first rabbi, just like you were at Adat Elohim in Thousand Oaks in Columbia, Maryland, was housed in an interfaith center, a building that was also home to the Catholic parish, three Protestant congregations, and two other Jewish congregations. The congregation has moved on in recent years and has its own building now. But for me, that was very special. And I enjoyed it immensely. So the opportunities to share Jewish life and the opportunities that I've had to teach at Christian seminaries and the like have been just highlights for me. I think it started for me when I was a kid in East Orange, New Jersey, and I was one of the few Jews in my class, and the teacher would always say, Stephen, can you tell us about this holiday or that holiday? And it was something that I found very enjoyable.
You write in a forthcoming book that's imminently being published. This is posting on the in the end the beginning of November. So it's a book called 75 and Me. You write about the power of hope, which is something. Talk to me about what you mean by that.
Well, I look at the 4,000 years of Jewish history and ask myself, why are we still here? How did we manage to overcome all of the forces throughout the course of history that have conspired to try to destroy us? And I truly believe the unifying ingredient responsible for our survival is that we have clung to hope. We have been, as Zecharia, the prophet, called us, prisoners of hope. And I think it's not an accident that Israel's national anthem is called HaTikvah, the hope, because as long as we've had hope that things can get better, we've managed to make them get better. And so this is a very, very vital concept in my whole, if you will, going back to your first question, philosophy of life.
Right.
All of us, while I've been very blessed in so many ways, life has also had its share of disappointments and setbacks. And being able to cling to the hope that if I hang in there and if I keep trying, things will get better. And if we as a society keep trying, things will get better. They do. And that is vital to me.
You have a section in 75 and Me that you could have been listening to every rabbinic conversation in recent years. I think you entitled it "Wither Reform Judaism." We're in the midst of this great age of transition in progressive Judaism in the United States. So Could you reflect on this? What did you mean by wither Reform Judaism?
Well, look, at 75, I realize, although I don't like to think about it, it's a reality. I'm closer to the end of my life's journey than to the beginning, and certainly closer to the end of my rabbinical career than to the beginning. And yes, much is changing and changing rapidly, and I found myself out of step. The reason I retired from the full-time pulpit in 2011, in part, was because I didn't relate in my own mind to the 30s and 40-year-olds. I didn't listen to their music. I don't watch their movies. I don't watch their TV shows. I'm of a different era.
That's one of them calling you now.
In many ways. So I feel like the movement is moving in ways with ideas that I find somehow difficult. The idea that one can be raised as a Jew and a Christian at the same time, which seems to be embraced by many of our younger colleagues. The idea, for example, that it would be okay, which is a rising surge of thought among our younger colleagues, for a rabbi to be in an interfaith marriage, alien to me. Throughout my career, I've resisted the requests that have been many to officiate at interfaith marriages because I feel like my role as a rabbi is to consecrate unions between Jews. I don't look down on people, of course, who marry out of the faith, and I welcome them to my congregation, but I've tried to, and I've been successful at explaining, while I respect them, respect their decision to marry, wish them well, want to help them in any way I can, my role precludes my officiation, my personal philosophy, and I've paid a price for that over the years, as have many colleagues. And the idea that some are proposing very, very strongly that, oh, sure, a rabbi married to a non-Jew, that's fine. So many of the things like that are happening in our movement disturb me, and I wanted to register, hopefully with respect and a sense of concern, my feelings as I move toward the exit, if you will, of my life and career. I hope that my thoughts are at least worthy of consideration.
So given the fact that we're in a great age of transition in North America, specifically in the United States, there is, as you know, significant differences, let's say, in the Canadian community. But put on your global kippah, do you sense this also do you sense in the progressive community around the world, because you do know this community, you worked in it and you were the president of World Union, do you sense a surge amongst various aspects around the world of people coming to a more progressive form of Judaism?
Well, my top agenda item when I was president of the World Union was legitimacy of progressive Judaism, because in many countries in like Europe and in South America, the government, there's no separation of church and state, and government funds synagogues, but they only fund Orthodox synagogues. And so a lot of time of mine was spent lobbying with officials, with legislators in various countries to present the case for progressive Judaism. And I think it's a case that we should present strongly. And yet, I think that there is a lot of assimilation in many countries and other than in Israel. And I think that as a movement, there are certain things we need to continue to embrace. And among many of our younger colleagues, the whole idea of concern with continuity is off the table. They just want to be a warm, welcoming place where anybody feels at home and we do good in the world. And we have these wonderful progressive values. Well, that's all wonderful. It is. But I also think there is a particular aspect to being Jewish that we need to preserve and continue to nurture. And so I think that in different places around the world, that is a tough battle to fight. But I'm glad to see that in Israel, at least, the progressive movement is fairly strong in maintaining those, I think, important boundaries.
Rabbi Stephen Fuchs, the rabbi of Bat Yam Temple of the Islands in beautiful Sanibel on the west coast of Florida. Beautiful place, beautiful place. So, Steve, what's in it for me, finding ourselves in biblical narratives and often the first Jew, both available on the usual places? I know they've been translated into how many languages have these been translated into?
Often the first Jew is available in German. What's in it for me, finding ourselves in biblical narratives, is available as an audio book. It is available in Russian. It is available in Spanish, and it's available in German.
So no matter where you're traveling, you can carry Rabbi Fuchs with you, right? Wise move. And 75 and Me, imminently available in the usual places, which includes, of course, the great God Amazon. Steve, my thanks to you. Regards to Vicky. Just continued good health. Stay safe over there, and hope to see you sometime soon in passing somewhere, somehow, once this pandemic is behind us, God willing. So thank you very, very much. Continue good luck. Hatzlacha. And todah rabah.
Thank you, Rich.
And to all of you who joined us today, thank you again for being part of this edition of Seekers of Meaning, the TV show and podcast of Jewish Sacred Aging. A reminder, if you'd like to make a donation, tax-free donation, no doubt, to help support our work and these podcasts, go to the website, jewishsacredaging.com, and scroll down to the conveniently located donate button. Click it and just follow the Seekers of Meaning is produced in the studios of Lubetkin Media Companies in beautiful Cherry Hill, New Jersey. And our usual shout out to the man behind who controls everything, not behind the curtain, our producer, Steve Lubetkin. Again, thank you for joining us. I am your host, Rabbi Richard Address, and I look forward to greeting you on our next Seekers of Meaning TV show and podcast. Until then, stay safe, everybody. Stay healthy. Take care. Tadah rabah.